From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. When each new Harry Potter novel captured the top spot on the bestseller list, a lot of publishers grumbled. They said children's books shouldn't be counted. And the New York Times actually created a separate bestseller list for kids' books. But the truth is, grown-ups as well as children are devouring these books. Harry Potter has become a hero for our time. And now he's a movie star. Today we'll analyze the remarkable popularity of the skinny little wizard with glasses and talk about the world of children's literature, from historical fiction to great picture books. Also, how a man on an assembly line became a prize-winning writer.
Working in the factory was kind of a thing that made me a writer because I was writing while I was in the factory, while I was actually in the factory, and it took me away from the job that I hated.
If you want to know what kids think about, the kind of stuff they don't discuss with their parents, you might want to read Katherine Patterson's books. She is one of America's most acclaimed writers of children's literature. Her book, Bridge to Terabithia, won the Newbery Award. So did Jacob Have I Loved. The Master Puppeteer and The Great Gelly Hopkins each landed the National Book Award for Children's Literature. In 1998, Patterson received the world's top prize for a children's book author, the Hans Christian Andersen Medal. Patterson is a master at digging into the emotional lives of kids. Talking to Steve Paulson, she said many adults have underestimated children.
People would like to deny that children have deep feelings. They will say, well, he wouldn't understand. The child may not be able to articulate what he's feeling as well as some adult, but it doesn't mean that she's not feeling very deeply. So what you're trying to do is to go so deep inside yourself that it will connect very deeply with the reader. And I seem to be asking the questions that children ask. And so when I go deep inside myself, I'm addressing questions that children address and are often not permitted to ask.
Like what kinds of questions?
What if I die? Adults are so afraid of death that they won't take children to funerals often. They are not honest about their own emotions, their anger towards the loved one who's died. Those kinds of things that we all experience when a loved one dies, children also experience. And for them, it's much more powerful because the younger you are, the more powerful you think your words are and that your words might actually kill.
So when you're writing a story, let's say, about death, and you say you go deeper into yourself to tap into that emotional experience, are you trying to go deeper into yourself as you were as a child yourself or just the way you are right now?
That child is what's deep, isn't it? So the deeper I go, the more into the child I go. And so I think that's why I can connect emotionally with children.
Do you think most adults just simply don't understand the emotional experience of children?
Well, I think maybe a lot of us don't want to believe our children hurt as much as they do because it's too painful for us to contemplate that. So we sort of deny it in self-protection. Or maybe we forgot how it felt.
What ages of children are you talking about?
Almost any age.
A 3-year-old and a 15-year-old.
Yeah. In fact, I got a lot of grief when Bridge to Terabithia was published because children shouldn't have to think about death. And I have 4 children, and by the time they were 8, 2 of them had lost friends by death. I didn't want my children to have to go through that grief. I didn't have any choice. And so I think what we need to do as parents and as writers for children is to try to help them develop some inner strength for the hard things of life that they are going to have to face.
Well, you've written about a number of heavy subjects. Death is one. Mm-hmm. You've written about foster care, even evolution. And not surprisingly, some of your books have been, I shouldn't say not surprisingly, but some of your books have been targeted for censorship. You've been accused in some circles of corrupting the morals of children. And I'm wondering if you see it as part of your job as a children's book writer to sort out what's right from what's wrong.
You know, the problem is when you start out with a value or a moral truth to impart, what you're doing is writing propaganda. If you have something that you wish to impart, and I've written propaganda. I hope it was good propaganda, because I've written to persuade. Mm-hmm. But that's not fiction. That's not a story. A story is the writer's self-discovery, what I'm learning. And you start with your own pain or your own puzzlement. And the process of writing the story is the process of trying to figure out for yourself something that you didn't know at the beginning.
Well, I find your comments about morality especially interesting, given your own background. Mm-hmm. You were born in China. Your parents were Christian missionaries there. You've been quoted as saying that the Bible had a profound influence on you. And
yeah.
the stories that have had the most impact were the stories
Absolutely.
From the Bible.
Absolutely.
I think most people would see the Bible as the book about moral instruction.
No, the Bible is the book about God's love for humankind. And that's quite a different thing from moral instruction. Yes, the Ten Commandments are very much a part of the Bible, but the Ten Commandments are given to us for our own good, not to bang us over the head with a stone tablet. If you live by the Ten Commandments, you're going to be a happier person.
So the Bible is not out there to whip you into line?
No. No. It's so sad when people think it is.
Well, I want to pick up on the thread of your own personal history. After you were born in China, you moved around a lot, didn't
you?
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Moving I can do. I mean, I hate it. But I know I was asked to write a story after I moved to Vermont for the children of farmhands who are the moving population of people in Vermont. And I didn't know anything about dairy farms. They took me out and made me walk through the muck to write a book about dairy farms and to talk to the people who lived on dairy farms and to go visit their trailers and to go to their schools. But moving I knew about. That was the emotional truth, if you please.
How many times did you move when you were growing up?
I don't know. I'm now living at my 33rd or 34th address. I can't. And most of those moves were made before I was married. So.
But you moved pretty much every year.
Yeah, when I was a child. There was only one school I went to for more than 2 years. So.
You must have always felt like the outsider.
I was always the outsider. I was always the dumb one who didn't know where anything was and who didn't know how it was done in this place. And I still find that child in me rising up when I'm in a stable community as I've been living in for the last 13 years, and there's this assumption that everybody knows something, and I don't know it. And I think, don't do that to people. Don't do that to people.
Did you get picked on a lot as a kid?
Oh, sure, you know, initially. And then by the time I would begin to feel at home and have made my friends, then we would move again, and I'd have to start all over again.
Did that experience make you a writer?
Well, it certainly contributed to my being a writer, I'm sure. I once said that I was sure there were very fine writers who'd had happy childhoods, but that those of us who were weird little kids had a leg up.
You had more to draw
we
on.
We had more to draw on. So they had to work harder than we do.
How have you turned those experiences into books? Your own early experiences as the outsider.
Well, when I was in the first grade, we came from China. We had to flee China twice because of World War II, and the first time we ended up in Richmond, Virginia, and I was put into the first grade, where I could already read well, but I was so weird that I never told the teacher I could read, so I was doing Dick and Jane, and I was totally invisible. And on Valentine's Day, now I had been there since the fall, on Valentine's Day, I came home, and I didn't have a single Valentine. Well, my poor mother, we feel too deeply for our children. She just never got over it till the day she died. And once she said to me, after I had become a writer of a number of books, she said, Catherine, why don't you sometime write the story about Ginner Park School when you didn't get any Valentines? And I said, oh, Mother, every book I've written is about the day I didn't get any Valentines.
We've mentioned one of your books that won the Newbery Medal. bridge to Terabithia, which is the story of how one child deals with his best friend's death. How did you get the idea for that story?
Our son David's best friend, who was a girl, was struck and killed by lightning. And it was such a horrendous thing that I had to begin to write a book to try to make sense of it.
How old was David at the time?
8. He was 8 years old. And thought God was punishing him and that God would go ahead and kill everybody he loved before God got through. And it was right at the time that I had been operated on for cancer, so the children were already afraid they might lose their mother, and then David lost his best friend.
So how do you turn that into a book, that kind of devastating experience?
Not easily. I stopped writing when I knew the next chapter would bring the child's death. Only way I could keep her alive was not to write. And when I finally realized that it was my own death that had to be faced, I went ahead and wrote it.
We should say that in the story, Jess and Leslie are the two friends. They come together over this secret hideaway that they have that they call Terabithia, and then Leslie drowns during a rainstorm as she's going there, and then Jess is left to his own devices to deal with it.
Yeah, and the child doesn't die by lightning because that would not be believable. I often explain to children that books have to be more believable than life.
This is pretty heavy stuff for kids to read about. I mean, let's say fifth graders. Those were that was the age of the children you were writing about.
I think of books, especially a book like this, as a kind of rehearsal for life. You get to go through it while you're still enjoying it. And I'm very often confronted by people who say, well, this child I know lost a parent or a friend, and so I gave them Bridge to Terabithia, and that's really too late. The child should have a book like that before she needs it. And I've had a number of letters from young adults who said to me that they've lost a friend, and they remembered Bridge to Terabithia and went back and read it, and that it was such a comfort to them.
There's a passage that you have near the end of the book, Bridge to Terabithia, where Jess finally realizes, I mean, he's obviously dealing with his grief, but he realizes he's been given a gift by his very dear friend. And I'm wondering if you could read that for
us. I'd love to read it for you. He thought about it all day, how before Leslie came he had been a nothing, a stupid, weird little kid who drew funny pictures and chased around a cow field trying to act big, trying to hide a whole mob of foolish little fears running riot inside his gut. It was Leslie who had taken him from the cow pasture into Terabithia and turned him into a king. He'd thought that was it. Wasn't king the best you could be? Now it occurred to him that perhaps Terabithia was like a castle where you came to be knighted. After you stayed for a while and grew strong, you had to move on. For hadn't Leslie, even in Terabithia, tried to push back the walls of his mind and make him see beyond to the shining world, huge and terrible and beautiful and very fragile? Handle with care everything, even the predators. Now it was time for him to move out. She wasn't there, so he must go for both of them. It was up to him to pay back to the world in beauty and caring what Leslie had loaned him in vision and strength. As for the terrors ahead, for he did not fool himself that they were all behind him, well, you just have to stand up to your fear and not let it squeeze you white. Right, Leslie? Right.
Catherine Patterson's many books include Bridge to Terabithia and The Great Gilly Hopkins. In 1998, she won the Hans Christian Andersen Medal for her body of work. She talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, what makes Harry Potter tick? I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. By now, J.K. Rowling's own story is legendary. A single mother on the dole in Scotland, she used to cart her infant daughter off to a coffee shop, where she wrote while her baby napped. Eventually, she produced a fantasy book, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. It became a huge bestseller. The rest of the Harry Potter books proved just as popular, and the new Potter movie will certainly turn into box office gold. Now, if you haven't read the books, a few words about Harry. He's a pretty ordinary kid who grew up in the muggle, or non-magical, world. Then he finds out he's a wizard with extraordinary powers, and to top it off, he has a special knack for soaring around on a broom in the game Quidditch. The Harry Potter books have turned a lot of kids into bookworms, as producer Veronica Rickert discovered when she talked with some fourth and fifth graders in Madison, Wisconsin.
Would you rather watch TV or read Harry Potter?
Clearly, the Harry Potter books have opened up a fabulous world of magic and mystery.
I like to go in the secret passageways because they'll lead you into unknown places.
It would be cool to have Harry Potter as a friend. He's really adventurous and he has magical powers. He's famous. It would be fun to have him as a friend because, frankly, A, whenever I wanted, I could ask him to please make a snowstorm, then there wouldn't be any school for a week. And B, and even when there would be, there would be something really fun going on, so I'd never have to take a spelling test again.
I like Quidditch because it's a fast game, just like soccer, except with four balls and you're up in the air on a broomstick.
If I was on a broom, I would feel like a witch.
I like these books because they're different. They're about a person who's gone through life being pretty miserable living where he lives, and then one day he just finds out that he's a wizard, and after that he just leads a fairly happy life.
I think I'm going to read them at least like 7 times because they're so good.
Children from Shorewood Elementary School in Madison, Wisconsin. You know, it is not just kids who like the Harry Potter books. I've read all three of them and thoroughly enjoyed them. But I still wondered, what is it that makes these books so special? So I called up a few writers and asked what they thought.
I'm Lee Siegel, a staff writer for the New Republic magazine. And I think that the Harry Potter books appeal to a wide range of people because they address issues and emotions and thoughts that are very close to people and do not get an outlet in what passes for fiction nowadays, or even our public discourse.
Do you think they're not, then, about fantasy, about escaping reality?
Well, I think there are two forms of escapism. I think there's an escape away from reality, an Indiana Jones movie, for example, which is a lot of fun, of course. But I think there's a kind of escape that goes deep into the heart of reality. And it's liberating because it gets behind appearances and it makes sense of life for us.
In the Harry Potter books, there is a split between, I guess you'd say, real life and Harry's reality, isn't there? I mean, his wizardry is part of it, but then there is the muggle world where the rest of us live.
Right. Well, I think that she's honest about that. She doesn't pretend, as, say, magical realists do, like Garcia Marquez or Günter Grass, that reality is continuous with fantasy. She acknowledges that there's a big difference between the mundane world that we dwell in, and the world of the imagination. And she invites the reader to exercise his or her imagination and take the leap from one to the other.
Well, what about the reality world that she's created? Is that our reality, do you think?
Well, I think it's partly our reality. The sort of Philistine uncle, Harry's uncle, he manufactures drills for a living. And Harry himself, once he's in the wizard world, he undergoes the hero's traditional journey from the surface of life to the depths of life and where he's endangered and has to fight for his life, and then back up again to a more harmonious surface. And so that contrast between someone who manufactures drills for a living and is very unkind, even cruel to Harry, and to Harry's journey, that's a lot like life, you know? You know, we're surrounded by dull moments and by a surface reality that does not acknowledge our deeper hungers. And in our moments of true feeling and true apprehension, we go beyond that. We know that there's more there. That's why these books are so beautiful. We human beings know and feel the truth of life, but so much of what passes for popular culture and serious culture does not address that. And somehow Rowling in these innocent-seeming books does.
I'm Henry Jenkins. I'm the director of the Comparative Media Studies program here at MIT. The other week, as I was on the road traveling, I wandered into a gay bookshop in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and saw a huge stack of copies of the Harry Potter books. And this caught my eye, obviously, because this is a children's book. It's not a book aimed explicitly at the gay community. Yet it was clear from that display and others that I've stumbled into since that it's a book that has really caught the attention of gay, lesbian, bisexuals across the country.
What do you think it is about Harry Potter that it would appeal to the gay community?
Well, I think you start with the fact that the very first chapter is about the shame that the Dursley family feels about their relatives and the horror they face when Harry is introduced into their home. The sense they worry about the perception of their neighbors, they're afraid about a scandal that might erupt, that Harry is forced to live in a cupboard underneath the stairs. Not quite a closet, but very close to one.
Sort of the classic outsider, isn't he?
He is something of, he is since faced by a family who fundamentally doesn't understand what makes him tick, what his desires are, what his goals in life are, what his lifestyle and values are. And that's a phenomenon that a high number of gay and lesbian teens in America face in their own families. They're often misunderstood. They're obviously most often raised by heterosexuals. There is still a scandal associated with it.
Now, I can see how you're making these relationships, but I'm curious whether you think that they're being made widely. I mean, Harry is the classic outsider, but not necessarily a gay outsider.
No, I don't mean to imply that he is gay at all, and let's be clear. In a sense, what I'm suggesting is the character is one that is designed to resonate with students who are outsiders in one way or another. Mm-hmm. That is, he's a kind of nerdy character. The nerd in our culture is a character who doesn't quite fit within the social community that he finds himself. The nerd is often, if it's a male nerd, is often treated as a little effeminate. A mama's boy, a bookworm, can easily be labeled as queer or gay in the school. Whether or not his sexuality is that way, he's often exposed to a kind of gay-bashing culture in the state of the schools in America. A female nerd is often characterized as a little too masculine, a little too butch. And I would suggest that those kinds of kids are kids that would gravitate toward a story such as Harry Potter, which really tells the story of an individual who's been singled out, who has been undervalued, and who rises to the occasion, who demonstrates competencies and abilities that no one quite realized.
My name is Allison Lurie. I'm a professor at Cornell University. I sometimes teach children's literature, and I'm also a novelist. I think that the Harry Potter books are so popular because, first of all, they're brilliantly inventive, and second, because they're in the tradition of English children's literature. They're child-centered, and they're full of magic and surprise, and they empower children over adults.
What is it, do you think, that lends British children's literature especially such an air of imagination? What is it about the British people that is it that they're childish?
No, I think it's that in Britain, childhood is more of a separate world. British children are not so family-centered as American children or children in some other countries. They tend to spend a lot of time with their peers. They go off to school much earlier. And, of course, they're living in a world which has a tradition of the romantic child, a tradition that childhood is a wonderful, delightful place to be, and that it's rather sad to grow up.
Why do you think that it is the magic that is so appealing about these stories? I mean, wouldn't it be enough just to go off to school?
No, I don't think so, because then you wouldn't have the sense that you're in a world in which some children have special powers and make friends who also have these powers. And you may have noticed when you read the book that Harry Potter, at the beginning of the first book, he's nothing special. He's not particularly intelligent. I mean, he's not dumb, but he's an average kid. He's average looking. He's sort of skinny and weedy, and he's not the kind of kid that would be hired to sell cereal on television, you know? these books appeal to children who feel that they're not perfect. And, of course, most people are not perfect. And when you're a child, you're especially aware of this.
I'm Don Esmond. I'm a columnist with the Buffalo News. And I think it would be nice if Harry Potter had been a girl.
Well, now let's just talk about this for a minute. Do you think that the book would have been really different if J.K. Rowling had made Harry Potter Henrietta Potter?
I think it would have been from the perspective of that girls who are the age and maybe even a little bit older than my daughter, my 7-year-old, would be able to see themselves reflected in a role that I think that they will play in life and that they should play in life. Mm-hmm. A role of a leadership role, an adventuresome role, a role where they're taking charge, where they're the leaders and not always the followers and the secondary person to the boy.
Now, in the Harry Potter books, there is a strong female character, his friend Hermione Granger, who is not willing to take too much guff from Harry. Do you think there are problems with her?
I do in some ways, and especially in the earlier book. I think she's your very conventionally stereotypical female, and she's not as athletic as Harry. She's very bookish and studious. She's always the one who's loaded down with books and constantly studying and absorbed with following the rules. And whereas, you know, it's Harry and some of the other boys who are more inclined to be the risk takers and the rule breakers.
Does it strike you as ironic at all that J.K. Rowling, who wrote the Harry Potter books and has had this huge success, is, well, of course, a woman herself, and at least according to what I've read about her, has a daughter, and yet she wrote about Harry Potter?
Right, and I think that's what first put the idea in my mind. I mean, if anyone was in a position to come out with, write books like this centered around a strong female character, I would have thought it was her. She's obviously a tremendous writer and wildly inventive to have created this universe that she has. And again, she's also a single mother of a daughter. I don't think we're reinventing reality here. You know, when girls are 10, 11, and 12, in many instances, they're bigger and more athletic than boys. There's a girl on the block I live on who's 11 or 12 years old, and she's better than the boys at street hockey and those other games that they play, and she's the leader of the pack. You know, and that's when I looked at her, I said, well, that's Henrietta Potter.
Don Esmond. We also heard from Allison Lurie, Henry Jenkins, and Lee Siegel. Coming up, how a factory worker became a prize-winning children's author. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. The fictional worlds of Christopher Paul Curtis could hardly be more different from the fantasy world of Harry Potter. Curtis writes historical fiction. His first book, The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963, is set during the civil rights struggle. His new novel, Bud, not Buddy, is about a young black kid caught in the Great Depression. Bud is hungry and homeless, sleeping under trees in the winter. At one point, he wakes up and runs half a mile to a bread line, only to find that it stretches out for blocks by the time he reaches the last man in line.
I walked up to get behind him. He said, "Line's closed. These here folks are the last ones." He pointed at a man standing next to a woman who was carrying a baby. I said, "But sir." He said, "But nothing. Line's closed. These here folks are the last ones." It was time to start lying. If I didn't get any food now, I'd have to steal something out of someone's garbage, or I wouldn't be able to eat until the mission opened for supper. I said, "Sir, I..." The man raised his hand and said, "Look, kid, everybody's got a story and everybody knows the rules. The line closes at 7 o'clock. How is it fair to these people who've been waiting here since 5? You sleep until 7:15, then come busting down here expecting to eat. You think you've got some kind of special privilege just because you're skinny and raggedy? Look in the line. There's lots of folks look just like you. You ain't the worst."
Bud, not Buddy, is not your ordinary children's book. But Christopher Paul Curtis thinks kids should learn about important historic events, like the Civil Rights Movement and the Great Depression. He told Judith Strasser that Bud's hard life is grounded in history.
Many, many children, some as young as 8 years old, either left their homes or were thrown out because there just was not enough food to feed them, and they set out on life on the road, riding the rails or going from place to place, begging, doing things like that. So I don't think Bud's life is really uncommon for that time.
He's, what, 10?
10 years old.
And he's off on his own. I mean, he gets kicked out of a foster home.
Mm-hmm. And refuses to go back to the orphanage. So he figures that he's going to walk across the state of Michigan to find the man that he thinks is his father. And he's on his own, yes.
You really write about difficult subjects, difficult times. Your first book was about another difficult time for black people. It was about the Civil Rights Movement. And in that book, there's a young girl who's in a church in Birmingham when it's bombed. Tell me about the Watson family that goes to Birmingham and why they went to Birmingham.
The Watsons go to Birmingham 1963 is a story about, not so much about the Civil Rights Movement, I don't feel. I feel it's a story about a family. And it starts in Flint, Michigan. There's a daughter and two sons. And a 13-year-old son, he's into being cool and skipping school. And he's just a kind of a semi-juvenile delinquent. And his parents have tried everything with him. And they decide that what they need to do is to ship him to his grandmother's house to spend the summer in Birmingham, because the grandmother is known as a strict disciplinarian. And of course, at the time, there was a great civil rights struggle going on in Birmingham. And the daughter is involved in a bombing, much like the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church that took place.
This is a really tough subject for adults to deal with. And I'm wondering how you do make them into stories for kids, a subject like the bombing of a church, or a boy who's trying to find his father, who's really essentially homeless, mm-hmm. trying to find his father.
I think that what I do is don't concentrate on the difficulty of the situation. Instead, concentrate on the child and the child's reaction. One of the things that I'm very grateful for in the Watsons Go to Birmingham is that before the bombing takes place, people get to know the family. Then when the bombing comes, it's not like they're approaching the story from the outside and there's this bombing. It's like a member of your family or somebody that you know, a friend, is in danger.
Is it the emotion that you want children to get, or is it the historical facts that this sort of thing really happened, or...?
Neither is the goal, I don't think. I think that knowing about the struggle is important, but that's not the point of the book. If you don't grab that child first, if you don't get their attention and don't make them feel like they're not going to be hit in the head with a lesson here, you know, in a lot of books you can see, oh, here comes the lesson. I think you can hear it rolling in. That's what I try to do. I try to make the story the most important thing. And then you can, once you've got the child into the story, then other things can be brought in and the child can look at it from a different perspective.
You have a very unusual background for a writer. You worked 15 years, was it? 13 years on the assembly line.
9/15/72 to 9/22/85.
Oh, you have the dates pinned down.
Oh, yes. Because I look at the 9/15/72 as kind of my first day in prison, and the other date is my date of freedom, so.
Had you always wanted to write? Were you wanting to write as you were doing that?
No, writing never was a goal of mine. I wanted to be everything else that a child wants to be. I wanted to be a football player. I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be a saxophone player. But writer never was on that list. And working in the factory was kind of a thing that made me a writer, because I was writing while I was in the factory, while I was actually in the factory. And it took me away from the job that I hated. So, you know, I say I hate it, but in a lot of ways I'm grateful, because I think it is what turned me into a writer.
When you say that you were writing while you were on the job.
I hung doors, and it was a really physical job. And there were two of us that did, and we do every other job. And in our 18-year-old wisdom, we figured that instead of doing every other job and standing up for 10 hours, it'd be a lot easier if I did 30 in a row than my friend did 30 in a row. And that way you'd have a half hour off the line every hour. And I found that when I wrote, it further took me away from the line. It took me out of the factory. Time would fly when I would sit and write. And I wasn't writing fiction at the time. I wasn't writing anything really that was worth reading. Mostly I was writing things like, I hate my foreman's guts. Things along that line. But I was, the actual writing is what I think was important, the practice of putting pen to paper.
What's interesting is that my impression, I mean, I've never been in a factory, I have to say, but I'm impressed that you were able to do that, to say, well, I'm impressed with several things. One, I'm impressed that nobody came down on you for taking a half hour off every, you know.
Well, they tried, but.
But I'm also impressed that you could take this a half hour is a very short period of time for writing, maybe long for hanging doors, but it's very short for writing, isn't it?
That's right. It is. It is. And it helped me in that it was such a short time. You know, you just start really get going, and it's time, you know, Doug would say, hey, come on, this is your job right here. And I'd have to jump up. And it also helped me in the fact that while I was working, I was thinking about what I was going to write when I went back. And so I was writing for half an hour, but I was thinking for half an hour, the other half hour.
So do you miss the physical part of your life when you're writing, now that, you know, you're writing full time?
The physical part of hanging doors?
Yeah. I mean, do you have to do something physical in order to write now?
No. Thank God that didn't happen. No, what I do now is I go to the library and I sit in the children's section and I write for 2 or 3 hours. The physical part is not necessary. No, I don't miss the physical part of hanging doors at all.
It's interesting that you talk about writing in the children's section, because the library is a very important place for Bud, the young boy in your second book. And I get the feeling, well, I got the feeling reading the book that the library must have been important for you as you were coming up. But
sure. Yeah, the library, I don't know why, but it's the only place I can write. When I wrote The Watson School to Birmingham, I'd sit in the public library and I'd write, and they weren't sure what I was doing, because when I write, I still go into the same kind of trance I was in at the factory, and I'm writing and I'm laughing out loud and I'm just having a wonderful time. And I remember when I finished The Watsons, I gave the manuscript to one of the librarians, because it's really hard to find somebody to read something that you've written that has any kind of experience. And I thought, who better than a librarian? And she took it from me, and I went back about a week later, and I walked in, and she saw me, and she started crying. And I thought, oh, wow, that's a good sign. I've made a librarian cry. So the library is very special to me, yeah, and to Bud, too.
Did she help you get it published?
No. I entered a contest to get the book published. It's almost impossible to get anything read by a publishing house unless you're well-known in some other field or unless you've already published something. So I entered contests, and the book didn't win the contest, but Delacourt published it anyway.
The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963, became a big publishing success, and Christopher Paul Curtis's latest novel, Bud Not Buddy, was the first book to win both the Newbery Medal and the Coretta Scott King Award. Curtis talked with Judith Strasser. These days, publishers can barely keep up with the demand for picture books, but only a few, like Goodnight Moon, Madeline, and Curious George, have turned into classics. So what makes a great picture book? Steve Paulson asked three experts. Kevin Hincus is the author and illustrator of the prize-winning books Owen and Lily's Purple Plastic Purse. Uri Shulovitz is also an author and illustrator. His award-winning books include Snow and The Fool of the World and the Flying Ship. And Barbara Barstow is a librarian who's chaired the Caldecott Medal Committee. They all say a classic picture book exudes a certain kind of magic. Take Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are, the story of the boy Max, who made mischief of one kind and another. His mother called him Wild Thing, and Max said, "I'll eat you up." The words suck you into the story, but the illustrations are what really bring it to life. Kevin Hincus.
It's drama in which the pictures get larger as the story intensifies, and it comes to a climax, and when it draws to an end, the pictures become smaller again, and it finishes on a page in which there is text but no illustrations at all.
When I was looking at that book last night, I was noticing how incredibly compact it is. I mean, just within three pages, you find out everything. You find out that Max is being yelled at by his mother. Max is angry. The forest starts to grow in the room. It's as if there's no word that's wasted, word or picture.
And I think that's one of the things that makes a great picture book. And I also think that it's original. There's nothing new about a kid getting into trouble or throwing a tantrum and working through it and having a happy ending, but it's how he did it that makes it unique.
Uri Shulovitz, what's your take on that book? What makes that book so special?
Well, to begin with, I mean, it is a true picture book, as Kevin has mentioned. I would like also to mention something, I mean, as an aside, but about Where the Wild Things Are, as compared, for example, to Peter Rabbit. In both books, what they have in common is that the hero disobeys mother. In the tale of Peter Rabbit, he's punished for it. I mean, he barely escapes with his life, pursued by Mr. McGregor. At the end, he's sick, and as a kind of a slight compensation, he's having chamomile tea, which he may not really care for very much.
Although some people read that as punishment, that he doesn't get
well,
the other stuff that his sisters
right.
get.
But that is not the case with The Wild Things Are. The Wild Things Are is something, it's quite different. Although Max disobeys his mother, he not only is not frightened by these creatures that are much larger than Mr. McGregor, but he actually comes out victorious. And not only that, when he returns, he is rewarded by a delicious supper waiting for him.
Well, Barbara Barstow, one thing that's striking about Maurice Sendak's books in particular, and I think Where the Wild Things Are is a perfect example, is there's a dreamlike quality to that.
Yes.
I mean, it doesn't just work on the conscious level.
Even the dreamlike quality, I think one of the most powerful things about this book is that it speaks directly to the child. There is no heavy-handedness to this book. There is more than meets the eye with this.
When you say child-centered, you're never getting the parent's perspective here.
I
mean, you're never getting a parent preaching and saying, you know,
exactly.
Max, you should be doing this. It's all from Max's point of view.
I think so. And the least successful children's books, picture books, winking over the heads of children, really speaking to adults. But Maurice Sendak is speaking to the child audience, and perhaps from his own memories of childhood and those dreams, the ability to conquer those things, which I think is what every child wants, the ability to be powerful enough to conquer the evil around them or the nightmares, the things under the bed.
Is that the secret of all great picture books, essentially getting inside the heads of the kids themselves, tapping into that childlike experience?
I think that's one very important thing. And I think if a book does become classic, it is because a child, many children, love it and want it again and again and again. A good example of keeping the child in mind is Vera Williams' book, More, 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 Said the Baby. It's just very simply a story about three children who have a loving experience with an adult, and the word love isn't in the book at all, and there are so many books out there now that I think are from an adult perspective that have love in the title and love is on every page, and this doesn't have that at all. The children have the adults kissing their toes and kissing their belly buttons, things like that, that are very child-centered, and I think that's why it's such a wonderful book, and it oozes love.
Well, I think that this is true, but also on the other hand, it's not that important, in other words, whether it's child-centered and whether it's speaking directly to the child, you know, by trying to do it that way. I believe that the good picture books, I mean, were first and foremost good books. The first books that children adopted were not written for children. Stories from the Bible, Don Quixote, Robinson Crusoe, none of them were written for children.
Don't all good picture books have to work both for the child and for the parent? I mean, after all, it's the parent who has to read it over and over and over.
I think that's probably true, and I think most good books have layers. A good book can be enjoyed on a certain level by a child, and that same book can be enjoyed enormously by the adult.
I also think that less than great books can be very much appreciated if an adult that loves that book and loves that child shares it with the child, because sometimes it's the bond between the two that makes you love the book.
Well, let me tell you my reaction to a different kind of reaction when I first read The Little Engine That Could to my daughter, and I probably hadn't read it since I was a kid myself. I'm sort of embarrassed to say this, but kind of tears welled up in my eyes when I got to the end, you know, that I think I can. And I remember that happened the first few times. Now I can't stand the book. Now it just seems so preachy, repetitive. Yes. The few times that I read it now, I skip whole sentences because I just find it boring. And
does she let you get away with it?
She does with that one. Uh-huh. There are other books that she doesn't.
So maybe it didn't pass the test for her either.
Yeah, maybe that's true.
I view it very simply this way. It's either a good book or not. I really don't believe in those distinctions, whether the book is for children. If the book is simple enough and speaking to the human being, it comes down to whether it's a good book or not.
Let me ask about illustrations, the role of illustrations, because one thing that I notice with a lot of picture books that are coming out now, ones that are not classics, is the art is sometimes beautiful. It's, you know, these elaborate, ornate paintings. And you go back to some of those old classics like The Runaway Bunny or Curious George. I mean, very simple drawings. And I actually wonder if the art can be too beautiful to work well.
I think frequently that does happen. What happens is that the very, very ornate things, the things, sometimes they overwhelm a story. Sometimes they take away from the child's participation.
And I think that's the difference with certain over-illustrated books or whatever you want to call them. I think they're beautiful paintings often, and they would look terrific in one's house. But an illustration has a different function. Right. And I think a good illustration, you can't take it out of the book. It's part of the whole.
You're quite right that there are a lot of very beautifully illustrated books now, more so than they were at the time when I started in the 60s. But one thing, you know, and this is kind of a generality, so it doesn't hold always true, but most of the time, they had a great deal of feeling. And today, unfortunately, there are some very beautiful books, but they don't have as much feeling.
Well, let me ask you about Curious George. And I don't know if you are Curious George fans around this table. You can tell that I'm being guided by the preferences of my children here. But a Curious George just ruled in my household for a long time. And I'm sure it has a lot to do with the pictures there. And I would guess from an artist's perspective, this is not great art, but I don't know. Somehow it's very captivating.
I think they're utterly charming. And I think H.A. Rey, again, I mean, they work. Those characters are alive on the page. They move. George, in his nonsensical way, is real in the way that I think other drawings can look stiff.
Even though the pictures are, they look very simple. I mean,
simple is
probably
hard to achieve.
Yes. Exactly, yes.
M.B. Gofstein had a quote that was something like, you work and work and work until it looks like you didn't work at all. And I think that's, again, often the case with a good picture book.
Let's talk about the texts of some very well-known books. Goodnight Moon, the text is so spare, so poetic. What makes that work? What makes that endure, that book, so that I as a parent, for instance, can read it over and over and I don't get tired of it?
I think you mentioned two things. It's spare and it's poetic. And I think there's not a word there that doesn't need to be. It moves. and you want to know what comes next. You want to turn the pages.
But it is larger than itself, and it does go beyond the child's world. I mean, at the end, the child says goodnight, I think, to the universe. So in other words, it really progresses. I mean, really, from the everyday objects, you know, it keeps on going. Then, you know, good night stars, good night moon. So therefore, the book is not slight. Slight would be if all you get is all you see, and that's it.
So really, what you're saying is, some of these books that become classics, they work at a metaphorical level. Mm-hmm. It's not simply dealing with the world at hand, but I guess it's Kevin what you were saying, and they work on different levels, right, and they somehow tap almost an unconscious level.
I think probably any good art does that, whether it's a picture book or a painting or sculpture.
I would use an analogy about this thing. It's like you're flying over an ocean and you see a tiny island. And what you see is actually, that's really what you get in the picture book. But a great picture book has also the fact that this tiny island is only the tip of a huge mountain, and that the bigger part is invisible. It's implied.
Give me an example of what you're talking about.
For example, The Happy Day by Ruth Krauss. The words are extremely simple. Mm-hmm. Different animals wake up, they run, they stop, they dance, and at the end, a flower is growing in the snow, and that's all. So what you see is actually, what's the big deal about it? It's just one little flower in the snow, but actually what it is, it's a cosmic event. It's the first day of spring. Hmm. And I think that it's just telling you about it, kind of. I feel like I'm my hair is standing up. And I think this is really what I mean by something that is larger than itself.
Uri Shulevitz and Kevin Henkes are both writers and illustrators of picture books. Barbara Barstow is a librarian who's chaired the Caldecott Medal Committee. They talked with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the Children's Books Show, number 19A. If you have comments or questions about the program, you can write to us at To the Best of Our Knowledge, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Or send us an email through our website at www.wpr.org/book.
PRI, Public Radio International.